If you were watching the tech feeds and financial markets on Sunday, June 14, 2026, you probably felt a little bit of vertigo.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was kind of a wild day.
Right. Because, usually you get like one major paradigm shift a month, maybe a disruptive product launch or some massive financial maneuver.
Yeah, that's the normal pace.
But looking at this massive edition of the Tech and Morning newsletter that we're diving into today, the ground didn't just shift in one direction. We saw multiple fundamental structures of the tech and financial worlds just entirely collide over a single 24-hour period.
It's basically the definition of a systemic earthquake. We are looking at a day where the underlying logic of how major industries operate was fundamentally challenged.
And our mission for you today is to cut through the noise of that massive data dump. We're going to distill this down so you have a shortcut to being completely up to speed on what actually happened and, more importantly, how it all works. We are completely bypassing the superficial headlines here.
Which is critical, I think, because if you look at the mechanics behind these stories, a very clear overarching narrative emerges. Across literally every topic we are unpacking today, you're going to see this fierce escalating tension
Tension between what exactly?
between decentralized innovation, technologies and assets that operate without borders, and centralized control, meaning, traditional governments and massive corporations desperately trying to maintain their grip.
Okay, let's unpack this because there is literally no better place to start than the ultimate decentralized asset, which is Bitcoin.
Naturally.
Right. So Standard Chartered Bank released this comprehensive analysis declaring that the crypto winter is officially over.
Yeah, they really planted a flag there.
They did. They pinpointed the exact bottom at $59,375. And their head of digital asset research, Jeffrey Kendrick, literally wrote the phrase, quote, "Winter is over. Welcome back to crypto spring."
And we should probably frame why Kendrick's statement carries so much weight. I mean, Standard Chartered has immense institutional credibility to begin with.
Right. They aren't just some fringe blog.
Exactly. And Kendrick is the analyst who accurately predicted the surge to $126,000 back in 2025.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so people listen to him. And now his team is targeting $100,000 for Bitcoin and $4,000 for Ethereum by the end of 2026.
That is a massive jump.
It is. But the real story here isn't just the price target. It's the underlying mechanism that caused the market to bottom out in the first place. It wasn't typical macroeconomic cycles.
Okay, so what was it?
It was a liquidity vacuum, one that was created entirely by the SpaceX IPO.
The initial public offering for SpaceX under the ticker symbol SPCX, they raised $75 billion. But how does an aerospace company going public drain the entire cryptocurrency market?
Well, it comes down to where institutional money is parked. Between May 25 and June 5, Bitcoin exchange traded funds, the ETFs, they saw $2.3 billion in outflows.
Wait, 2.3 billion?
Yeah. Institutional investors and massive funds needed liquid capital to buy into the historic SpaceX IPO. So they systematically liquidated their crypto ETF positions. They basically drained the room of capital.
SpaceX's IPO was like a massive financial black hole, just sucking all the capital out of the room.
That's a great way to put it. But the moment the SpaceX IPO finalized and that capital was deployed, the vacuum reversed. Those same Bitcoin ETFs suddenly saw $180 million in daily inflows
So
resume.
the black hole closed and the money flowed back. But the twist in the newsletter is what we found out after the IPO, right?
Yeah.
Because the real bombshell was buried in their Form S-1 amendment.
Right. So before a company goes public, they file an S-1 with the SEC. It essentially strips the company down to its financial studs for regulators and potential investors to examine.
To see what's really under the hood.
Exactly. And in their amended filing, SpaceX revealed they have $1.3 billion, specifically 18,712 Bitcoin, sitting directly on their corporate balance sheet.
That is insane. Once the dust settled, we find out they've essentially Bitcoinized the aerospace industry.
Yeah, and Michael Saylor, the CEO of MicroStrategy, immediately jumped online to point out that 25% of the Magnificent Eight, which now includes SpaceX alongside Tesla, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Alphabet, Meta, and Nvidia, are officially Bitcoinized.
So a quarter of the biggest companies in the world.
It signals a profound shift in how the world's most valuable companies view corporate treasury management. You now have two of the eight largest companies on Earth publicly abandoning traditional cash reserves for substantial decentralized assets.
Okay, but hold on. I have to push back on this narrative just a
Why,
bit.
sure.
Yes, $1.3 billion is a staggering amount of money for a normal person.
Mm.
But SpaceX's stock popped 19% on its first day of trading. their market cap is now an eye-watering $2.1 trillion.
Right, they are massive.
So if you do the math, that $1.3 billion in Bitcoin is only like 0.07% of their total value. Is this a real, genuine financial strategy? Or is this just Elon Musk having fun with the corporate treasury?
It's a fair skepticism, absolutely. But the mechanics of SpaceX's business model explain why this is actually highly strategic. The S-1 filing explicitly defines this as a strategic reserve for excess cash generation.
Okay, so they are treating it as a real reserve.
Yes, and look at their operational horizons. SpaceX doesn't work on typical quarterly corporate cycles. They operate on 10 to 20-year project timelines.
Right, because you can't build a Mars rocket in 3 months.
Exactly. They are funding Mars missions, permanent lunar base construction, the global expansion of Starlink. If you hold billions of dollars in fiat currency over a two-decade horizon, inflation is going to aggressively erode your purchasing power. Cash loses value over that kind of time.
So despite its short-term volatility, Bitcoin's fixed supply offers protection against that long-term dollar debasement.
Precisely. And there's a very practical operational layer to this as well. SpaceX has active commercial customers in over 60 countries.
Oh, right. Dealing with 60 different currencies sounds like a nightmare.
It is. Operating globally means dealing with foreign exchange friction, international banking intermediaries, the delays inherent in the SWIFT banking system. Bitcoin provides them with a borderless settlement layer. It moves at the speed of the internet, completely bypassing traditional financial choke points across all those 60-plus countries.
So for the listener who might be managing your own portfolio right now, what's the practical takeaway from these massive institutional maneuvers?
The source material offers a very specific strategy for average investors. Don't try to time the exact market bottom.
Which is impossible anyway.
Exactly. Instead, utilize a 12-week dollar-cost averaging plan, a DCA plan. Just set a fixed amount to invest automatically every week to smooth out the volatility.
And if you're an investor who, say, bought in near that $126,000 peak and you are currently sitting on some heavy losses, what then?
The recommendation is to consult a CPA regarding tax loss harvesting before the end of the year.
Which, just to clarify for anyone unfamiliar, tax loss harvesting is when you deliberately sell an asset at a loss to offset the taxes you owe on capital gains from other investments, and then you can strategically re-enter the market later.
Right. It's a way to turn a portfolio red mark into a tangible tax advantage.
Okay, so we just talked about a massive corporation embracing a borderless, decentralized asset to bypass traditional friction. But on the exact same weekend, the U.S. government took unprecedented action to abruptly hit the kill switch on a borderless frontier technology.
Yeah, we need to look at the situation with Anthropic. Late Friday, June 13, the U.S. Department of Commerce invoked national security and emergency export control powers.
And what did they actually do?
They forced Anthropic to globally shut down access to its two newest artificial intelligence models, Claude Fable 5 and Claude Mythos 5.
And the scope of this order is just staggering. Globally means everyone. American citizens, allied nations, even Anthropic's own non-U.S. engineers were instantly locked out.
Just completely cut off.
And this happened a mere 3 days after these models launched to massive industry fanfare. 3 days.
Well, the Department of Commerce cited severe dual-use threats.
Okay, dual-use meaning?
Well, dual-use technology is something designed for commercial benefit, but that possesses inherent capabilities for catastrophic harm. According to the government's justification, internal red team testing revealed these models could generate highly sophisticated zero-day exploits.
Meaning they could write code to attack previously unknown vulnerabilities in critical infrastructure.
Exactly. They also allegedly provided step-by-step guidance on synthesizing bioweapons using easily accessible laboratory equipment.
Which is terrifying. And the Mythos 5 model was singled out specifically for its architecture, right? It features a massive 2 million token context window.
Yeah, that scale is unprecedented.
For anyone listening who isn't building AI, a token is roughly a piece of a word. So a 2 million token window means you can feel the AI the equivalent of dozens of thick technical textbooks, entire databases of chemical formulations or global supply chain logistics all at once.
And the government argued that this massive memory, combined with the model's advanced reasoning, could assist hostile actors in planning incredibly complex, multi-stage strategic operations.
Right. Plus, it demonstrated the ability to generate scalable, highly persuasive social engineering campaigns across 40 different languages simultaneously. So the government's stance is that these are acute, catastrophic national security threats that absolutely justify an emergency intervention.
But Anthropic released a very sharp rebuttal. Their core argument is that OpenAI's GPT-5 and Google's Gemini Ultra 2 possess the exact same capabilities and the exact same context windows.
Wait, really? The exact same?
Yes, yet those models are operating freely without any restrictions from the Department of Commerce.
Okay, we need to be completely impartial here because this gets into some heavy politics. We are just reporting the source's analysis. But I have to push back on the logic of this shutdown. If OpenAI and Google have the exact same capabilities available to the public right now, how does shutting down just Anthropic solve a global security issue? I mean, it feels like locking the front door of your house because you're worried about burglars, but deliberately leaving all the windows wide open.
This raises an important question, and it's exactly why the tech industry is completely fractured into two camps right now.
What are the two theories?
Some analysts argue the government simply panicked because effective jailbreaks methods to bypass the safety filters of Fable 5 spread across underground forums within 24 hours of its launch. So it was a legitimate security scramble.
And the other side?
Others theorize this is selective enforcement. They view it as a protectionist policy, heavily favoring established incumbents like Microsoft-backed OpenAI and Google, while kneecapping a major competitor.
Oh, wow.
But regardless of which theory is true, whether it was a genuine national security emergency or an act of protectionism, the immediate fallout for the tech ecosystem is identical. Right. It establishes a terrifying precedent. I mean, imagine you run a startup. You just spent the last 3 days integrating the Fable 5 API into your production systems, building features for your clients, and by Friday night, your entire product is broken.
Not because of a bug in your code?
No, by sudden regulatory fiat. Your business is completely unplugged without warning. This creates a massive existential risk for developers.
And the geopolitical ripple effects are enormous, too. The newsletter points out this will likely drive international developers, specifically in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, straight toward Chinese models like DeepSeek R2 or Alibaba's Qwen.
Exactly. Because those are open weight models.
Meaning the actual core code and parameters are publicly available.
Right. With an open weight model, you download the architecture directly to your own servers. You own it locally. And because it isn't running through a centralized American corporate server, it is entirely immune to U.S. export controls and arbitrary shutdown orders.
So by attempting to assert ultimate control over American AI, the U.S. might inadvertently accelerate the global dominance of foreign decentralized models.
That's the irony here. So, to you, the listener, whether you're a developer or a business owner, the takeaway is absolute. You must diversify your AI stack. Do not hard code your business to rely on a single centralized model.
You absolutely need fallback systems. The source strongly suggests exploring open source alternatives like Llama 3 or Mistral Large that you can self-host. Mm-hmm. A model running on your own physical hardware cannot be shut down by a sudden Department of Commerce directive.
Resilience is no longer just a best practice. It's a mandatory survival trait.
Yeah, that tension between legacy centralized models and modern realities perfectly bridges us to our next topic. Speaking of existential threats to developers, we are seeing what happens when massive centralized tech structures become too heavy to sustain themselves.
Starting with Microsoft's current profit crisis.
Right. Reports from The Information, which were later confirmed by Reuters and IGN, reveal that Microsoft is actively exploring spinning off the entire Xbox division.
They are evaluating turning it into a wholly owned subsidiary, forming a joint venture, or pursuing a complete sale.
But why would a $3 trillion company consider shedding one of its most famous consumer brands?
We just have to look at the margins. Xbox generates an impressive $21 billion in annual revenue, but its operating margin is an anemic 3%.
3%.
Yeah. Now compare that to Microsoft's core enterprise businesses. Azure Cloud Services operates at a 42% margin, and Office 365 sits at 45%.
3% profit on $21 billion. It's an incredible amount of effort for pennies on the dollar compared to their cloud services.
When your core software lines are returning up to 15 times higher margins than your gaming hardware division, a structural restructuring becomes inevitable. Shareholders of a company Microsoft's size demand consistent, massive profit growth. Xbox has basically become a financial anchor weighing down the overall corporate balance sheet.
So Asha Sharma, the new CEO of Xbox, is attempting a massive turnaround plan. She's trying to fast-track major franchises that have been stuck in agonizingly long development cycles.
Yeah, she wants to bring in external studios to get Halo 8 out by 2027. Accelerate the Elder Scrolls 6, and start parallel development for Fallout 5.
probably to capitalize on the massive success of the Amazon TV adaptation.
Almost certainly.
But the core problem isn't just slow development. The core problem is the business model itself, specifically Game Pass. Look, as a gamer, Game Pass is an incredible deal. I pay a flat monthly fee and get access to hundreds of premium games.
It's amazing for the consumer.
It is. But for Microsoft, Game Pass is an all-you-can-eat buffet that is mathematically bankrupting the restaurant.
What's fascinating here is that the underlying structural assumptions of the gaming industry have fundamentally changed. Microsoft built Xbox on the classic console subsidization model. You sell the physical hardware at a loss to get the box into the consumer's living room, and you recoup that loss by taking a 30% cut of $60 or $70 game sales.
Yeah, the old razor and blades model.
Exactly. But modern AAA video games now cost upwards of $500 million and take 5 to 7 years to develop. You cannot recoup a $500 million development budget when your primary revenue stream is users paying a flat $15 a month.
Especially when you're competing against Sony's PlayStation Network, which commands nearly double the monthly active users.
So if Xbox is spun off into an independent entity, free from Microsoft's relentless shareholder demands for Azure-level margins, what happens?
Well, an independent Xbox wouldn't have to protect Windows or drive Microsoft ecosystem lock-in. They could optimize entirely for market share and software sales.
Which means, for the gamers listening, we could see Game Pass launch natively on the PlayStation 5 or the Nintendo Switch.
It would completely shatter the walled gardens of console gaming.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Microsoft assumed an old economic model would hold up in a modern market, and it's costing them billions.
Mm.
In the cybersecurity world, Splunk assumed an old networking model would hold up in the modern cloud, and it has triggered an absolute nightmare.
Splunk Enterprise just disclosed CVE 2026-2253. It carries a CVSS severity score of 9.8 out of 10.
That is basically as bad as it gets.
It is. This is an unauthenticated remote code execution, or RCE, vulnerability.
For those who aren't in IT administration, Splunk is essentially the central nervous system of enterprise security. Banks, governments, major tech companies, they all use it to ingest logs and monitor their networks for intrusions. But this 9.8 vulnerability allows an attacker to completely compromise the Splunk platform without needing a single password.
And the mechanism of the attack centers around something called a PostgreSQL sidecar service.
Okay, what is a sidecar in this context?
In modern cloud architecture, a sidecar is just a helper application that runs right alongside the main application, handling specific tasks like data storage or network routing. Splunk 10.x introduced this PostgreSQL sidecar to manage database tasks, but the developers made a fatal structural assumption.
What did they assume?
They assumed this sidecar service would only ever be accessed from within the trusted, heavily guarded internal network, the local host. Because they assumed it was walled off from the outside world, they simply did not implement any authentication controls on it.
Oh, wow. That is like discovering the state-of-the-art security camera system you bought for your house actually prints out spare keys for the burglars.
That's a perfect analogy.
Or it's like building a bank vault with massive steel doors, but using a pneumatic tube system for the tellers to move cash around. The architects assumed only trusted employees inside the building could access the tubes, so they didn't put locks on the tube doors. But in modern, complex cloud environments, the perimeter is porous. An attacker can reach that tube from the outside.
And once they reach it, the damage is catastrophic.
Right.
If an attacker gains even basic low-level network access, perhaps through a standard phishing email or a compromised employee VPN, they can scan the network for that open sidecar port. Because there's no password required, they connect directly to the database.
And then they're in.
Completely. From there, they can read sensitive configuration files, write malicious web shells, and achieve persistent remote code execution.
And the newsletter notes they're using cron jobs to maintain that persistence, right?
Yes. A cron job is just an automated scheduled task on a server. Attackers use the open sidecar to schedule a malicious script to run every single minute.
Oh, so even if you detect the malware and delete it,
the server automatically reinstalls it 60 seconds later. They effectively blind your security team by compromising the very monitoring system you use to detect them. And then they use your Splunk server as a beachhead to attack the rest of your corporate network.
So to the listener, if you are an IT admin or a systems architect, consider this a drop everything moment. You need to treat this as a P0 emergency. Check your Splunk deployment version right now.
If you are running anything below version 10.2.4 or 10.0.7, you must patch immediately. Download the patches, schedule the downtime, and lock down network access to that specific PostgreSQL port using strict firewall rules today.
And critically, review your access logs. Look for any newly created files or strangely modified cron jobs. When you are dealing with a 9.8 vulnerability on a core security appliance, the industry standard is that you must assume you have already been breached until you can definitively prove otherwise.
Absolutely.
Okay, after unpacking billions of dollars in ETFs, liquidity vacuums, emergency AI shutdowns, and critical zero-day vulnerabilities, let's close out with a brief palate cleanser, something a bit more elegant. Let's look at a scenario where instead of massive centralized mandates dictating terms, a developer is handing control directly back to the end user.
It is a really refreshing contrast, and we found it in the upcoming release of Onimusha, Way of the Sword.
Yes. Capcom just released the technical specs for the game, which launches on September 25, 2026, reviving the franchise after 15 years. Now, on the PS5 and the Xbox Series X, the game targets a dynamic 1440p to 4K resolution at a locked 60 frames per second.
Which is the standard performance benchmark we expect these days.
But the Nintendo Switch 2 version is taking a highly localized, distinct approach to its hardware limitations. Here's where it gets really interesting. Instead of forcing a rigid compromise, the developers introduced a unique variable frame rate mode specifically for the Switch 2.
Rather than locking the game at a cinematic 30 frames per second, they allow the frame rate to fluctuate freely between 30 and 40 frames per second.
Which fundamentally changes the feel of the game.
It does. It trades absolute visual pacing, meaning the screen might occasionally stutter or tear slightly during heavy action in exchange for raw input smoothness.
Right, because in a combat-heavy game, letting the frame rate uncap slightly means your controller inputs register faster. It's a smart, localized compromise. It gives a bit of nostalgia for older PC gaming, but more importantly, it gives control directly back to you, the player. It lets you decide which experience matters more on handheld hardware.
It's a small detail in the grand scheme of things, but as we synthesize everything we've explored from this incredible June 14, 2026 newsletter, that concept of choice versus mandate is the defining theme.
It really is.
Today was the day the tension between centralized control and decentralized innovation reached a critical mass. We witnessed traditional governments issuing emergency global shutdown orders on AI, traditional banks scrambling to validate decentralized cryptocurrencies, and Microsoft's corporate board struggling to wrangle the economics of digital communities. Centralized powers are desperately trying to corral borderless forces.
And as those tectonic plates continue to grind against each other, we want to make sure you are equipped to navigate the fallout. Whether that means setting up a dollar-cost averaging plan, immediately patching your Splunk servers, or ensuring you have self-hosted open-weight AI models ready as a backup.
Because knowledge is only truly valuable when it is understood and applied. And as you apply what we've unpacked today, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over.
Let's hear it.
We just saw the U.S. government unilaterally shut down a global AI model overnight to assert ultimate national security control. But simultaneously, we watched a massive corporate entity like SpaceX adopt a borderless, decentralized currency specifically to escape traditional financial boundaries.
Two completely opposite approaches.
Exactly. So when these two opposing philosophies inevitably collide at the highest geopolitical levels, which force ultimately wins the 21st century, the regulators, or the protocol,